Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Hi, welcome to the Football Writers Podcast. My name's Mike Calvin. I'm joined by Jonathan Northcroft of the Sunday Times and Dave Kidd of the Sun. It was billed as the season of the super managers. Since it's party time at the Bridge, we know who's done the best job. Take a bow, Antonio Conte. While Jose poses, Pep preaches, and Arsene patronises, he delivers. Fair enough?
Pretty much, Mike. That's good. Good intro. It's been an incredible season for Conte's management, hasn't it? I mean, he has, it's the quality of his work, and it's also the volume, the work ethic, I think, that stood out. I mean, he said in his pretty much his opening press conference the word work 32 times, and that's what's been that's what lain in store for the Chelsea players. But all managers try and impose effort. What he's been able to do is take players with him, take big players with him, take players with him who the season before maybe weren't all pulling in the same direction. He's got a talent for getting inside the minds of top footballers. We saw that with Juventus, and I think he's done that with Chelsea. On top of that, there's the tactical nous that he's shown in reorganising and drilling his players into doing what he wants tactically, because he does the same thing as Pep Guardiola. He spends a lot of time on positioning, he spends a lot of time on patterns of play. But you can see one manager has made his players get that very, very quickly, and the other is still a work in progress. So there's a lot of things to commend Conte for, and he really feels like a deserving sort of winner of this season.
And what's most striking to me, Dave, is that he said, look, this isn't my team yet. So that bodes well for next season. In that sense, they're going to show him the money, a salary around about 12 and a half, 13 million, something like that. What do you expect him to do in the transfer market? How will he strengthen this team to make it his team?
Yeah, I think he's going to have to buy a new striker because Costa doesn't want to be there, and you would imagine Lukaku would be an obvious replacement, and there's some suggestions that maybe he's not so keen now, but I think Lukaku will go there. I think he'll be looking at the wing-backs. I think he did a good sort of make-do and mend job with those. Alonso's been very good, but Moses... Moses is a title-winning wing-back. It, you know, testament to how good Conte's work is. If you'd have said that last summer, people would have laughed at you. You never thought of Moses as being a wing-back at all. Certainly not a title-winning one who's played 30-odd games this season. So I think he'll probably still be looking for an upgrade there. It's really more of a case of having more strength in depth when you're playing in the Champions League. They haven't necessarily got a lot of that. They haven't needed it this season. There's, Wenger rightly pointed out, and no one would deny that is a massive boost to you when you're not playing in Europe at all. You've got you know every week free to do stuff on the training ground.
Didn't you find that a bit patronising though?
It was patronising, yeah, but it's true. Still, yeah, I mean, it's, yeah, I mean, Wenger hasn't won it for 13 years, but it is true. And the fact is that the title, the Premier League title, has become incredibly difficult to retain. It's 9 years now since anyone's retained it. It's extraordinary. In no other major European league has that happened for many, many years. You've not had a single team retain it, and the last two champions have not had any European football while they've won it. It is the one thing it is. It's not the best league in the world. Mm-hmm. It's possibly not even the most exciting. It is the most physically and mentally grueling. Mm-hmm. That's a fact, I think.
What about
the sense of authority that he exudes. Now, you were in that Sunday press conference, which was chaos by the sounds of it, with Conte with his fire extinguisher. Yeah. Can you give us a sense of, what it was like to be there, and two, the reaction of the players? He obviously didn't say anything to them, but they knew they could only push him so far.
Yeah, it was an extraordinary scene. I mean, it started with the main press conference, which, and the root of it was that this was 2 hours after full-time. So you had a busload of Chelsea players waiting to get to a party in London, we thought. And Conte was still there 2 hours after the game, giving his press conference. The door opens, Diego Costa, David Luiz, and John Terry sort of rushed in and kidnapped him, basically, just hauled him out of his chair. Steve Atkins, the Chelsea head of comms, played an absolute blinder by chasing him down the stairs. I think very few press men would have done that.
They didn't get the idea of a separate Sundays, did they?
They didn't. No, exactly. What about the Sundays? And Steve hauled them back. But then you had this amazing scene where the players followed us all back into this cramped little room. And I suppose it was an insight into what, you know, Premier League defenders face when they're playing against the nutcase that is Diego Costa, because I mean, he was howling like some sort of animal. He was doing pull-ups on a bit of scaffolding, and then he picked up this fire extinguisher, and Sam Wallace of the Telegraph rightly sort of said, he'll use it, you know. And you looked at his eyes, and yeah, he was going to use it. Conte, throughout all of this, and Conte's got a lot of authority, and of course he's had a clash with Diego Costa and won it during the season. There was a certain indulgence. He was enjoying the moment, but then one of the players touched his hair, and you saw him bristle, and the line was drawn there. It was an insight. I felt Conte was letting them off the leash a little bit, but you knew that he was still the boss. And what it also told you was how desperate those players were to let their hair down, because he's kept them on such a tight leash all season.
You said you expect Costa to go, Dave. A lot of talk about Bakayoko coming in from Monaco, Van Dijk from Southampton, you know, strengthening the spine, really. Have Chelsea almost changed in nature now? You know, they used to be the big bad guys, didn't they? Abramovich's money. Has Conte actually made them... Is it now acceptable to like Chelsea?
They're more likeable. Any club without Jose Mourinho, and it's more likeable, I think. if he's your front man, and as much as, you know, we love him in terms of the copy he might give us, he's a scowling face. Yeah. His dark moods are no longer just dark moods. That's just permanently the way he is. So when he leaves the building, a place becomes much more likeable. I think Abramovich, I wrote something last week saying that he possibly deserves a bit more praise than he gets. He's actually been there for 14 years.
And he's put £1 billion in, whereas the Glazers have taken £1 billion out.
Absolutely, yeah. He's been there for 14 years. He's built a state-of-the-art training ground. He's building a state-of-the-art stadium. He's not a fly-by-night owner. We might wonder where the money came from, etc., but what he's done as a club owner has been really quite excellent. We might not like the way he spent in the early days to get Chelsea to where he is, but they are basically self-sufficient, and they are the only club I can see challenging for the Champions League in England in the next few years. They're the only ones who have done in the last... Well, Manchester City had a go under Pellegrini, but I think Chelsea have always been the most convincing English team in Europe under several different managers. I think the club, the infrastructure of the club is actually pretty good. I don't think they're the big bad wolves that they were considered, certainly maybe under in the early Abramovich years and the first time Mourinho was there.
I think he's evolved, Abramovich, hasn't he? I mean, that crisis point they had of the season when they'd lost to Liverpool, lost to Arsenal, what was telling was Abramovich appeared at the training ground, but not to sort of threaten, but to support, and had lunch with Conte, I think 3 days in a row, and basically mandated Conte to go and make the changes that you want now.
Because basically at that time, especially after the Arsenal game, we were all thinking, here we go again, weren't we?
We were. And it was put to me from within Chelsea that maybe 7 or 8 years ago that would have been it. You know, in the Scolari or the AVB era, they might not have been given that bit of time. But I think Abramovich has learnt. Don't forget, he's personally pretty much chosen Conte. Obviously, we know that he had this love affair with Guardiola and wanted him, but you know, he's very hands-on in terms of transfers and the choosing of managers, so his football knowledge in bringing Conte in probably has to be recognised as well.
The other great event of the weekend was White Hart Lane, last game in 118 years. You were there, Dave. just give a sense of what it was like, one, to be there, and what a ground, an old ground like that, means to people. It, to me, it's almost like the humanity of the game comes out in that situation.
Yeah, I think for supporters, I said it about my club's ground, is the one place that you will call home when you're a kid, and you may well call it home when you're 75 years old. So when you lose that, even if you're only moving next door, the place is going to look completely different.
To be clear, that's Craven Cottage for you, isn't it?
For me, yeah. But if we ever left, it would be, you know, incredibly sad, a real wrench. I understood. Some people were saying, oh, they're only moving next door, what's all the big deal? But it's going to be a completely different environment. The character of that place is fantastic. I was lucky enough to be there, say, the night Gareth Bale's night against Inter Milan. It was one of the best atmospheres I've known in an English football ground. Yesterday they did it really well. You compare that to the shambles at West Ham a year ago when they left Upton Park, the violence outside, the utter shambles inside, the fact it was an hour late. The classiness of Tottenham shone through, which West Ham said a lot about the people who run that club, I think, to be honest. I thought it was a terrific send-off yesterday. There was a half-an-hour interval where people got on the pitch and a lot of them didn't want to come off, so it wasn't entirely smooth. But once they had all got off the pitch, I don't think it was much later than scheduled. The parade of legends, it was done in quite an understated sort of way, but really well.
No taxes anywhere.
No, absolutely. No real gimmicks. There was a gospel choir which kind of spoke of the people who actually live around in Tottenham these days. There's a large black community, and they were represented by this wonderful gospel choir singing the Tottenham anthems, Glory, Glory, Tottenham Hotspur, etc. And that was a fantastic touch. But just this parade of sort of, I think it was 48 legendary players of the last, going back to the double winning team of 61, just coming out one by one. And I thought it was an excellent send off.
Yeah, those sort of occasions almost telescope time, don't they? You know, I looked at that and I remember I'm old enough to remember the first year that I was a football writer on the Telegraph, I covered the 1984 UEFA Cup final. And it was my first on deadline, penalties type of event. And I can remember leaving the ground that night when Steve Perriman was on the balcony showing the cup off to people who basically blocked Tottenham High Road. And I remember that like it was yesterday. What are your memories of it, of that ground?
Well, I mean, as a Scot and as an Aberdeen supporter, my first sort of link with Spurs is really Stevie Archibald and watching this place, that team that they had, which was very sort of boisterous and attractive team. A club that wasn't hard to fall in love with a little bit from afar. And then coming down to England, I would say there's probably three grounds that really struck me as you smelt the history and you felt you were going into, a kind of timeless world. And it'd be Goodison, Villa Park and White Hart Lane for sure. And I think it's every time I've been there, I think there's always been some sort of legend on the pitch at half-time. So I think it's a club that's the other impression I always get of Spurs. Club that's very good at knowing its history, and in terms of specific games, it's probably a funny one, but the two games this season that I went to back to back, 2-4-0 wins, Watford and Bournemouth, they're not hugely significant games, but I think what I'll take away as a memory will be that young team, that team in progress, with the cranes in the background, building the new stadium, playing the sort of football that Spurs are playing now. Really uplifting experience and a feeling that you were seeing both, the past and the future sort of coming together. I mean, that probably be those two games back to back would probably be my high point of the whole season, to be honest.
You're talking legends, Dave. You know Jimmy Greaves very well. He couldn't attend yesterday because of health issues. What do you think he would have made of that occasion?
I think he'd have loved it, actually. I think I saw Jim last week, and I think he would like to have gone. It's quite difficult physically, and sort of. I think they actually showed him round the ground one last time, about a month ago. I was actually surprised Jim went, simply because even when he was well, he wasn't a great goer of. He wasn't a great watcher of football matches. Really, he rarely went to Spurs when he was well. Rarely went to Chelsea either. So I was surprised, pleasantly surprised that he went, and he really thoroughly enjoyed it. I think there was just a feeling that yesterday would have been too much for him. It's not an easy place to get in or out of for any of us, is it? White Hart Lane, and that's one thing that they're not going to change. There's going to be twice as many people in the new stadium and just as bad transport links, so that's going to be a nightmare. But anyway, Jim was one of the great A-list legends of that football club, and until very, very recently, was the highest goal scorer in any top league, any of the top five leagues in Europe of all time. You know, he was that great a footballer, and it's easy to forget that. But Spurs, as you say, they do keep in touch with legends very well. The fact that Jim didn't go to Spurs was because Jim didn't particularly want to go to Spurs for many years. It wasn't a case of Spurs not looking after Jim at all.
Mm. The other absentee was Gazza. He issued a statement, and it was really poignant. You know, he said, "I wish I hated football because then I wouldn't miss it so much."
Yeah, Gazza in a way represents that sort of dread, that thing that all footballers confront when they stop playing. They all tell you there's nothing to replace it. Even the ones that become really successful managers tell you that all they're really doing is trying to recapture part of what they had as a player. And the contrast between Gazza and the joy that he provided and indulged in on the pitch, and then the Gazza post football is pretty symbolic of how difficult it is, I think, for ex-footballers. And particularly somebody like Gazza, who you know, a fairly damaged person in some ways, and football was so much a part of his life. You feel very sad, but in a sense, times like these are when you remember. You should remember Paul Gascoigne at his absolute peak, and when you think of Spurs, and you know, White Hart Lane, he's indelibly linked with that, of course.
The crowd yesterday sang his name twice at length, once being actually during the parade. I think it was the only name that they actually sang. You know, he was the sort of absentee that they were clearly sorely missed by them all, and they wanted to commemorate him. So
that's great. If we look to the future, how good can this Tottenham team be? Third, second. Next season first?
Yeah, I'm not so sure. I think if they were still at White Hart Lane, I would back them to win the title. At Wembley, I think they'll struggle to make the top four. And I think this has come at the wrong time for Tottenham. There's not much you can do about it, but they've got a team that is just hitting peak and could win the league if they had a home ground. They won 17 games in a row at that ground. Mm. They won 17 out of their 19 league games. They won 17 in a row in all competitions there. At Wembley, their record's been appalling. It's never going to be the same. That it's such an atmospheric, tight ground. Wembley couldn't be any more different. They could be playing in front of Stoke on Tuesday night in front of, a half-empty stadium, sadly. That's going to make a big difference. I wonder whether a season in reverse, which I think next season will be, is going to tempt players such as perhaps even Kane and Ali to move away. It's really sad. I'd love to see Spurs stay there at White Hart Lane for another season and win the league there. That would be great to see as a neutral. I think it would be great. I love watching that team. It's been really brilliantly put together by Pochettino. And the other problem is that Pochettino is a player, he's a manager who loves working with young players and doesn't necessarily get on so well with senior players. And the problems he's had with Walker in recent months, and Walker will be leaving in the summer, is because he doesn't particularly like players with a bigger voice, players who challenge him more in the dressing room. He likes working with young players. And I think we'll see, in the years to come, that if Pochettino sticks around, that might be more challenging for an Ali or a Kane when they become more mature. Mm-hmm. Bigger men, bigger voices in the dressing room.
Across North London, Arsene Wenger is now telling us that it's not going to be a disaster if they don't make the top four. Discuss.
Well, I suppose what we'll at least see is this kind of dependency Arsenal have got on Champions League money and that kind of comfort zone being broken, and we'll see if it galvanises that.
Yeah. Do you expect Liverpool to do the formalities against Middlesbrough?
I do. In fact, looking at the fixtures now, I'd say City are more vulnerable than Liverpool. If City just, who struggled against Leicester, and if they draw on against West Brom, it's not likely. I wouldn't bet on it, but I just think they're actually probably more vulnerable. But Arsenal, I mean, I was there at the weekend, they were everything you'd want in a team. You know, they were fantastic going forward, but they were also pretty good at the back. They out-muscled Stoke, and you thought, what have you been doing all season? Where's this been? Mm-hmm. And Wenger got the bit between his teeth again, because he's got his team in the right direction, but it's so late. And what does it actually mean when they've just repeated the pattern of previous seasons? I think out with the whole top four question, what they really need to do, irrespective of whether Wenger stays another season or not, is actually get some proper direction in that football club again. And the most alarming thing for me is his resistance to a director of football, because I'd have thought if there's one football club that is crying out for a director of football, you know, it's a club where the transfers haven't been good enough and where they've got a huge decision in terms of replacing a coach looming on the horizon. Surely somebody has to come in and plan that. And Wenger is very selfish to resist that, I think.
Mm. Do you expect him, you know, Lequipe are talking about him signing a one-year contract, which is almost a way to shove him out the door, it seems to me. Do you think that Wenger will win his power struggle that's going on there?
I'm not sure if there is much of a power struggle, really. I think Wenger does whatever the hell he likes, always has done and always will do. They're an extremely good team when there's no pressure on them. That's exactly what they've shown. When there's no pressure, they're a very technically very, very gifted team. When there's any pressure on, they are remarkably soft. I'm going to use stronger language there.
In that sense, is Sanchez signing a new contract almost as important, if not more important, than Wenger signing one?
Yeah, possibly. There's a lot of talk about Sanchez being a slightly disruptive influence. I think he's only, from what I gather, only a disruptive influence because he's got a bit more about him and he's more happy to... he's less happy when things aren't going well. He doesn't like being in a comfort zone, and too many of those players do, unfortunately. But yeah, Sanchez, in terms of his attitude and his talent, I think it'd be massive for Arsenal.
Mm. You mentioned City, Jonathan. A nearly season, or worse than that?
I think it has to be seen where they are next season, because this could be sold as a transitional season, and that's what...
Which it will be, won't it?
But either way, yeah. But I think what Pep Guardiola hopes is that this was the season where they made the bridge from one set of players, one set of playing philosophies to his era, and that, you know, we'll see this great team next season. I'm not entirely so sure, because we spoke about Conte earlier and how quickly he's imposed his ideas and how those ideas have actually matched up with what you need in English football pretty well. We're not quite sure whether that's the case with Guardiola. I'd say it's been a deeply disappointing season, however transitional he wants to say they are, because really, to still be scrabbling around to get in the top four, to have flopped in that cup semi-final against Arsenal, for me that was pretty unforgivable, and Champions League campaign was okay, but no more than that. It's hard to really make any great claims about this City season, to be quite honest, other than to say I think Gabriel Jesus have found a very, very good player, and Leroy Sané is a good signing, so you can see a future forward line, but a lot of work to do elsewhere.
Mm, yeah, Pep says, you know, we're the most creative team in the Premier League. Not quite sure about that, you?
No, not really. No, and quite frankly, it's all about balance, isn't it? And they haven't got a defence, and it was pretty obvious last summer that they didn't have a defence that was fit for purpose. And if it isn't entirely new back four, back five, including the keeper, are they going to gel immediately and win the title next season? I don't think so. I'm not convinced. I've always been sort of sceptical about Guardiola, and I don't really understand why what he did at Barcelona and Bayern Munich necessarily made him a messiah. He inherited some very, very good players. He did well, extremely well to mould what he moulded at Barcelona, and they were the greatest club team I'd ever seen. But he inherited Messi, Xavi, Iniesta, and I don't see how you can compare it. So I was always sceptical. I wanted to be convinced, and I haven't seen anything this season that's convinced me that he is a genius.
Mm. What do you think about these clubs that almost portray themselves as dynasties? Chelsea, you've got an academy, which frankly is very producing players for other clubs. Mm. At City, you've got a £200 million academy. You've got a global network of clubs. But what does that mean?
Exactly, Mike. I mean, you know, I know you've written a lot about this, but it shows how the youth side of football has become an industry in itself and not really serving the purpose that it should serve, which is, you know, feeding young talents up the chain into first team football and developing them as footballers properly and giving them opportunities. It seems to me that City and Chelsea are two incredibly rich football clubs whose youth departments have been told to go away and become the best youth departments you can be, win lots of stuff. So they've gone and done that. They've spent a lot of money on it, but it doesn't match up with the first team at those football clubs, and it doesn't match up with any particular long-term ethos or planning. And really, I haven't seen youth development work anywhere where it's not all pulled together by a manager that truly believes in it, and maybe a club that institutionally believes in it. So you think of United under Ferguson and what Pochettino's doing at Tottenham now. Until clubs do that, then to me it's slightly meaningless how many youth cups you win. It's players in the first team. That's what it's about.
In that sense, what do you think's going on at Liverpool, Dave? If we say, do you accept that they're probably going to finish fourth? Is that good enough for Klopp this season? And what about the long-term future of the club? He's channeling Shankly whenever he can, if you like, talking about the importance of youth development. Alexander-Arnold, Woodburn's been in there, although he's not done that great. What about Liverpool? Where are they at the moment?
I think they've possibly overachieved by reaching top four, if you compare them to where everyone else, the rest of the top six were. I think they've done well. I don't think they've got a squad as strong as any of the other five at the top. So I think he's overachieved. I don't see, where they're going in terms of building a title-winning team. I don't see that. I think they'll struggle unless they invest seriously and very well. It's not just a case of how much you spend. Unless they recruit very, very well, I think they're going to struggle fighting on two fronts. And remember the last time they were in the Champions League, they sort of waved the white flag at Real Madrid and played the reserves in the Bernabeu, which was just seemed to trash the club's traditions,
on the bench,
really.
Wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a real reserve team, wasn't it, in the Bernabeu. It was just looked terrible, didn't it? And I think that was because Rodgers didn't think he had a strong enough squad to compete on both fronts. And I don't think much has changed in that sense, really. I don't get the impression they have that strength in depth. They've got some very exciting attacking players, but I still think they need to do a lot defensively.
Mm. What about Coutinho? How good could he be, Johnny? He's playing in that deeper role, that sort of number eight role, isn't he?
I've always preferred him in that role, actually. I mean, who am I? But I think he makes a lot of sense. He's such a fantastic passer of the ball. Nets the play.
Pass for the first goal against West Ham was brilliant, wasn't it?
Sensational. And I think you want him on the ball facing play. I think his defensive work's improved an awful lot since he came to England, so he is capable of doing more than the defensive side of the game. But I think as a number eight, he makes perfect sense. He's committed to Liverpool, which is...
What, despite all the Barcelona rumours?
Yeah, he is. He is. I think that says a lot for him. It also helps, though, when you've got a really top striker to pair his passing ability with. And I thought what the West Ham game did again for Liverpool was gave them this tantalising glimpse of Daniel Sturridge. Mm-hmm. And Dave's right to say that they're quite a long way from a title-winning team. If you're looking at building blocks, a striker of that ability is something any title-winning team would want to have. And one of the big challenges or questions for Klopp must be, can you have another go at Daniel Sturridge? Can you maybe try and get him on the pitch every week and centre of your plans?
Yeah. 21 goals in the Premier League 3 years ago. Since then, he's started 24 matches out of 113. That tells you everything, doesn't it?
Statistic, isn't it? It really is. He's the most gifted, naturally gifted English striker since sort of Lineker, at least, I'd have thought. Yeah. As a pure finisher, his ability, his technique is outstanding. And we'll remember the sort of Anfield spring 2014, 3 years ago now, and he was outstanding in a great forward line, obviously with Sterling and Suarez. But you put a fully fit Sturridge in that Liverpool side now, 38 games a season, and they're a lot closer to winning a title. But you just don't see it, do you? We don't see it. We hear an awful lot about whether there's a certain mental aspect. We know there are a lot of footballers who will play through the pain barrier, and other players who are less able to, not willing to, but able to. It's just a fact of life. I think that some players, I don't think it's necessarily a criticism, but clearly Sturridge is not one of those players who is willing to play through serious pain. And a lot of players do, and a lot of players have done. And Frank Lampard played every game for 8 years because he had the ability to play with pain. And Sturridge doesn't have that, and probably Gareth Bale doesn't have that. There's several players you hear it about. And it's sad because it's sad for England as well, because you know he's a tremendous footballer when he's fully fit.
Mm. Talking of sadness in England and Manchester United, Wayne Rooney.
Yeah.
What about his personal and professional situation at the moment? It seems very precarious on both fronts.
I agree, and I think that both should be at the forefront rather than money when he makes his decision this summer, because I think he will leave United. I think he should leave United. I think he's wasting his time if he doesn't. And I think they do go hand in hand, like they do with a lot of footballers, but I think with Wayne in particular. You can see it on the pitch. You can see him physically when he's playing right, he tends to be at a point where everything's going right in the background. He's in the right physical shape. He's living right. So I think what he needs is a football challenge that's going to inspire him and inspire him not just on the pitch, but you know to be as focused and as proper as he should be off it. And I don't think going to China is going to be the answer to all of that. I rather think. It has to be, you know, the Everton option, or I think Chris Waddle put this forward in midweek. You know, it'd be great to see someone like him go to Italy, for example, where, you know, if he can adapt the lifestyle, they've got a great way of getting older players to perform throughout their 30s, and maybe with that slightly lesser pace to the game, then Wayne could flourish. But I hope this is a happy resolution to the career, and the next couple of years aren't as difficult as this one, or more difficult than this one's been for Wayne already.
Mm. Where do you see United in all this, Dave? You know, we've talked about Jose Mourinho. Well, we always talk about Jose Mourinho, don't we? He is going to get away, it seems, with fielding weakened sides against Southampton and Palace. Is he right to almost denigrate the league and by pushing it so far in the background and concentrate on Europa League?
I don't think he's necessarily wrong. I can understand why he's done it, and he'll be proved right as long as they beat Ajax. But it's a risk, because you know you get a player sent off in the first 5 minutes, and you know they could lose to Ajax anyway. Ajax are a very gifted young team, but United are strong favourites to win it. They probably will win it, and then he's got away with it. I don't have any great problem with that. What I do have the problem is why he keeps moaning about the fact he's got to. You know, does he think that the league should? Yeah. Just so you don't have to fulfil these fixtures, actually. What's he actually moaning about?
Yeah, what's he want?
He's moaning for the sake of moaning. What's he actually want? He's been going on about kick-off times all season. I've been trying to work out when he actually wants to kick off games. Maybe at 8 a.m, so it could be exactly 3.5 days after his last match and 3.5 days before the next one. He moans for the sake of moaning all the time.
Yeah. I'm quite sure. And does his attitude, does it permeate his team? Because, you know, I thought in that and the Celta Vigo game, fear permeated that performance, and they could quite easily have gone out.
They are a very odd mix of fear and actual mental strength, if you think about it. They're very like Jose himself, that team. I mean, they've ground their way to 2 cup finals. I was trying to remember particular performances along the way in either of those cup runs. I'm trying to remember particular performances in that 25-game unbeaten run. You can't. The team of grinders, you have to say, he has brought mental strength, but he's also brought this sort of caution and negativity. And
does it matter that he doesn't live up to the tradition of the club, the culture of the club?
I think long-term it really matters. I think at the moment, United have fallen so far away from where they needed to be that if you're talking about a hierarchy of need, then suddenly, you know, just achieving something became top of the list rather than anything else, style and tradition. But over time, style and tradition become absolutely essential again. So those are questions for him to answer. And to be fair, it's not his team yet, and we'll see where. And I did feel that his Chelsea team played some very good football. And I know he's not always been given credit for playing good football, but I think Mourinho teams are capable of doing that. So let's see where he is in a year's time. But, you know, he's trying to present this as some kind of heroic season. This has been a terrible season for Manchester United, I think. They win the Europa League, they've got away with it.
I think I quite like the fact that he goes for trophies rather than fourth place. Yeah. And that's always been his... You know, it sounds a bit simplistic, but he actually likes winning trophies. And Wenger's not that bothered, is he? Wenger's much worried about finishing fourth.
Yeah. What about Everton? Let's look at them very briefly. And I agree with you that it could be a perfect place for Rooney to end up. Ross Barkley, You know, he's got this ultimatum, sign or sayonara, see you later.
Yeah.
What do you think will happen there? And does he deserve a new contract at that club? Shouldn't he look around and think, I need to reinvent myself somewhere?
He does. I think what the saga is about is Koeman knows he's pretty much going to go, and he's taking control of it by calling him out. And you know, he's a local boy. You're supposed to love the club. Are you going to sign or not? And I don't think Koeman can lose by doing that. I think what Ross Bartley, which is what you're alluding to, Mike, is he should be focused on developing himself. And I don't think he has developed enough as a footballer in the last couple of years. So whether he stays or goes, he's got to put some work in as a footballer to unlock all of that talent.
Mm. Let's look at the bottom end of the table and relegation. David Moyes. It seems to me that even since that relegation was confirmed, the belief and almost the will has been draining out of him at Sunderland. Do you think he deserves to keep his job, or do you think he will be around next season?
I can't see him turning that club around. It's going to be a hell of a job, I think. And he doesn't. He seems to be a man. Johnny knows Moyes a lot better than I do. But he just seems like a man who's had the sort of joy and the lifeblood drained out of him. It looks like he needs a rest and to come back reinvigorated, you know, maybe a year down the line or something. Because he went in there. I don't know why he took the job. He seemed convinced they were going to go down anyway. And let's face it, they have stayed up every year. You know, they found a way of staying up 5 years in a row. He seemed to go in there and seemed to talk it down from the word go. I couldn't quite understand that. They were terrible to watch whenever I saw them this season. They really just didn't ever look like scoring goals. The whole place was, you know, this thing about this nickname of, is it the energy vampire or something they've called him? But the whole ground, you know, there are specific actual travel problems going in and out of stadium alike at the moment, but the place, you know, empties on the hour when they're 2-0 down, and it's just the most dispiriting place to watch Premier League football. I don't think we'll be seeing Premier League football there again, whoever the manager is, for a long while.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, he hasn't been backed particularly well by the owner. The club was in a bit of a mess. We had lots of bad contracts given to players when he arrived, but you know, I think it is fair to say that since having the Manchester United job, I think he's struggled for maybe that fire and that motivation that made him such a great manager in the first place. And psychologically, you can understand that. You've had the job of your lifetime. You've had your dream job. You feel you weren't given a decent crack at it. And everything else since then maybe has felt a little bit, you know, anticlimactic. But David does need to rediscover that spark. I think he will stay if he wants to. I'm not sure if he's going to want to, and it's going to be, as Dave said, masterminding that very tough job that now lies ahead at Sunderland. Maybe that's for someone else.
And it's, yeah, as you said, Dave, it's probably a 2, 3, 4, 5 year job.
You get that feeling, don't you? You don't think like Newcastle last season, where you thought they'd probably win, you know, go down and win the league. That seems like a squad that needs a major clear out and a complete rebuild, and as the whole energy around that club seems wrong. The owner wants out, doesn't he? Yeah, the owner's wanted out for a while now. That's the main problem. Until that's solved, until a new owner comes in who wants to be positive and build for the future, then it's difficult to see them.
Is it any coincidence, Dave, that you could almost say the same thing about Hull City? You've gone down,
yeah.
You know, despite Silva's best efforts as a manager, and he's impressed everyone.
Yeah.
Money's uncertain. Players are going to have to go. The owner's reviled by the fans, and he wants to get rid.
Rightfully so, because he's, you know, they've shown complete contempt towards those supporters in terms of the naming of the club, and they won't even use the name of the club in club merchandising. It's extraordinary, extraordinary car crash of a club. The last summer at Hull City was just a sort of black comedy. It was extraordinary. There were no players there. They'd just been promoted to the Premier League, and there were no players. I think Phelan did a pretty good job just to keep them vaguely afloat and give them a chance, you know. Of course, Silva's done well, and it actually showed a little bit of a willing on their behalf to bring him in and make quite a bold appointment, someone that we didn't know an awful lot about, maybe I didn't. And he's come in and at least, you know, got a good run of home results together. The thing with Silva is he's suddenly the favourite of the month, but in the two key games, Sunderland at home, Palace away, his team hasn't shown up. So there still should be question marks over him.
What about Sam Allardyce? Has he answered a few questions about himself yet again?
Yeah, he has. And but you know, we're talking about bouncing back. He has certainly done what David Moyes didn't do. You know, he's had his dream job. He's had that taken away from him. He was in a dark place after losing that England job. But there is something. Because you can see it in Sam as a person. There's something very resilient about him, and I think he's turned that disappointment into a positive energy. He's really enjoyed showing us all, you know, what Sam Allardyce can do again, and he's infected the club with that. And the impressive thing from a management point of view for me is if you look at that first six or seven games, results didn't actually change the way that Palace wanted them to. He not only kept his nerve, but I think it took that period of time because what he was doing was taking the time to re-engineer the team to be a Sam Allardyce team, laying the groundwork, and that's proper coaching. That's not just sort of trying quick fix stuff, and he's made it work for him.
But let's not forget, Dave, that he, out of all managers, he spent the most in January.
Yeah, he didn't. So Sacco was a very good signing, particularly, wasn't he, as well. They were 17th when he went in, and then they were still 16th maybe before yesterday's game against Hull. He did well. He did what he always did. It wasn't a miracle. They've got very good players there. They shouldn't have been as low as they were. They've got a lot of very good and very expensive players at that club, but they shouldn't have been anywhere near the bottom three. I don't
think. Do you think he can build a club?
I don't know. I mean, I think he can build it to a certain level. If you ever get to a point where you need imagination and flair, and you need to become more expansive, and I don't think he has got that. I think he surprised anyone at all. I don't think he had anything to prove, and he hasn't proved anything since he went there. He's done what he always does, which is, you know, structure a team very well, and win enough games to keep them clear of relegation. That's what Sam does, and that's what he will continue to do.
And that's what Paul Clement has done. Do you think he deserves a bit more credit than he's received so far?
Yeah, well, I mean, I see he's been nominated for Premier League Manager of the Year among five or six, and that's absolutely right, because he's done a better job than Silva, you have to say, because his mission's accomplished, and he's had less praise. He's held his nerve because they really wobbled Swansea. He's made good coaching decisions, putting Leon Britton back in the centre of that team, getting... maybe adapting his own football philosophy to get the best out of Llorente, playing a bit more direct to him. I thought Tom Carroll was an excellent signing. There's a lot of good stuff that's gone on there, and you know he's come from Bayern Munich to go and do that. He's got his hands dirty and pulled it off. Lot of respect for him, and it won't be long before he's getting talked about for bigger jobs, I don't think.
Well, do you think that British managers have an inbuilt sort of disadvantaged? It's easy to go out and get a foreign coach, perhaps, you know, with a greater global reputation, and there's that element of almost mystery about it.
There's some of that, but I also think that English coaches have got to take their opportunities when they get them, and Clement's done that, and he could be a real sort of standard bearer, because very few have in recent years. You know, there's the Championship playoffs, there's four foreign managers there who've come in and taken over failing clubs and transformed them completely, those teams, Fulham, Sheffield Wednesday, Huddersfield and Reading. Teams at the bottom of half have been transformed by a guy who's come in and done a great job. Clement, I think it shows that sometimes in England we don't like to look at people who haven't been big name players. That's the problem we've often had in English coaching, is that, you know, Clement was a school teacher and he was in Fulham's youth academy. He's a career coach. I know he's got, you know, he had a footballing father and a footballing brother. He had football in his blood, but he wasn't a professional footballer. And it's quite difficult, you know, compared to in other countries where, say Mourinho and Villas Boas and people in Portugal came through from having never played professionally. There's tended to be a real glass ceiling for Englishmen who haven't played the game at any level. And Clement could be a real standard bearer for those, actually. And because they're completely different skill sets, playing the game and coaching. There's no need, you know, there's no reason why you should, almost no reason at all, apart from the show us your medals kind of thing. If you can get over that with a bunch of players, you say, well, I haven't got any medals, but actually I'm a very good coach.
You know, management is a fashion business.
Yeah.
There will be changes this summer.
Yeah.
Interestingly, Thomas Tuchel seems to have fallen out of love with Borussia Dortmund. Do you expect him to play in a Premier League market somewhere?
Soon, maybe not quite this year. And he's beloved of the hipsters, shall we say. I mean, they rate him very highly. I don't know enough, to be quite honest. I'm not afraid to say that. From the outside, he looks like he's finished third to behind Red Bull Leipzig. So it makes me wonder, you know, with one of the top two clubs in Germany, it makes me wonder exactly how good he is. Plays nice football, but does he win stuff? That said, he's fashionable. He is anointed by Guardiola as one of his own sort of, you know, from his school, and that will count for something. And he probably will get a decent Premier League job at some point. Maybe, as I say, maybe not next year, but probably fairly soon. Mm.
Do you expect to see Claudio Ranieri back? You know, there's a lot of talk about maybe going to Watford.
Yeah, Watford sounds like one that...
Mm. West Ham, maybe.
You can see the Italian owners. He's got obviously got a great pedigree in the Premier League. I think West Ham will stick with Bilic, actually. They do tend to stick with their managers. The Golden Sullivan at Birmingham and at West Ham, they're not real great sackers of managers. And, you know, he's done, I think, a pretty decent job, all in all. Wonder whether he might be slightly soft on his players at the time. He's very popular with players. That's not always a good sign when they're that popular, because you get the impression that, like about Liverpool game, that they've just slackened off, haven't they? They've played really well for their cup final against Spurs, won that, and then... So... But I still tend to think, my gut feeling is they'll stick with Bilic. Ranieri for Watford would probably be a better fit, maybe. More likely.
Well, what about Southampton? It was Marco Hu, but now everyone wants a piece of silver. I see him at Southampton, you know. Thanks for joining us here on the Football Writers Podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.